This is pretty much Pop and Culture Podcast, and I really hope one of you guys wrote down what we're supposed to talk about today, because the mission assignment message self-destructed in like 5 seconds. Today we are talking about the series of Tom Cruise running videos that comprises the Mission Impossible film franchise that launched in 1996, taking its theme song, it's a few bits of premise from Bruce Geller's TV show that ran from 1966 through 1971. I'm Mark Lintemeyer. I think this series really failed in its potential as a star vehicle for Emilio Estevez.
I'm Al Baker, and I'm just delighted that a movie about the International Monetary Fund has managed to run for so long.
I'm Sarah Lynn Bruck, and the real Mission Impossible is trying to remember the plots for each of the Mission Impossibles.
Preach.
This is Lawrence Ware, and it may take me a while to get going, but I will wow you in the end.
So who watched the whole damn series of films for this, bro?
The whole damn thing.
Me.
Multiple times.
All right.
I did it for enjoyment. They did it for homework.
Yeah, that's fair.
I had never really connected these. I had seen all these films, but I'd never made any attempt to connect them together. I just watched them, you know, 5 years later when this one came out, whatever, such that I just would mix them all together. I didn't have much conception of when a character was returning. I felt like all the support characters, like Simon Pegg, who I love and other things, were really, really underdeveloped. But now actually seeing them in sequence,
no,
I feel like I appreciated this a little better. And I know that the new film is getting some bad press for being so exposition heavy. And so I just saw it as a seamless continuation. So I was basically fine with that.
Wow.
Wow.
This was really good fun, much more kind of fascinating than I thought it was going to be. I think I've only ever seen the first two Mission Impossible movies before. I think maybe I'd seen one or two of the others kind of on in the background, but I watched the whole thing right from the beginning to the very end, and I have so many more thoughts than I thought I would do about this franchise. It is, I think, more than anything, clinically fascinating, like about what it says about Tom Cruise in particular as a person and as a filmmaker and as a star. And about like the way he makes movies and the people that he has in his orbit. He is a fascinating character. The movies on the whole have so much to say about them. The most recent one, I mean, my headline, I haven't seen any of the reviews, but to me, it felt like the most elaborate gaslighting attempt that a movie has ever made, maybe since the original Gaslight. Certainly the most well-funded gaslighting attempt that I've ever kind of sat through. It was exactly what you said, Mark. You were like, oh, I never, you know, connected them all together before. I never thought to kind of think of them as one connected story. And I was about to say, well, you then have a lot in common with this film franchise, because it is clear that they also never thought to connect these movies together until the very last minute. But the movie spends the whole time trying to convince us that all the time we've been sitting through this elaborate pre-planned grand narrative arc, which was very, very funny to me. There's a lot about the movies that is very, very funny to me. But it was really aggravating and frustrating in so many ways. But it is so hard to stay mad at these films, because when they do what they do best, it's just so much fun to sit through. Like almost universally, my experience with these films was the first half thinking, oh my God, is it ever going to end? And then the second half is some of the most fun action that you've ever seen in a film. So yeah, great. Interesting, fascinating, clinically.
I want to hear Sarah's take, because I think once we unleash Lawrence, there's going to be no turning back. So go ahead, Sarah. Say your...
So I watched the first Mission Impossible, the 1996 version, in the theater and loved it. Watched the second one as well in the theater. Did not like it as much. And then I just sort of fell out. Like, I don't know what happened. I just didn't really return to it. And so when...
Well, there was a long gap.
There was a long gap. True. Yeah. And I guess the next one came out. Oh, my daughter was 2. She was turning 2 when the next one came out. So that's why.
You didn't think that was good watching for her, for a 2-year-old?
No, we were too busy watching Dora the Explorer. But it was really fun. When I found out that we were going to do this, you know, we went to the theater, saw the very long last movie, and then I went back and I just rewatched, you know, the first two and then every single one after that. And definitely some ups and downs, I think, with the series, but I love the sense of humor. The action sequences are unparalleled. It is preposterous. It makes absolutely no sense sometimes.
Oh, that's too far.
I found that I didn't really care. There were so many things, so many concessions I was willing to make, including all the Tom Cruise nonsense. But I still really like the series. I don't know what it is about it. I mean, there's definite flaws, which we will go into. But overall, I found that it was really, really fun.
Mark, can I be
released? The Kraken.
release the Lawrence.
Okay. I watched the first Mission Impossible in the movie theater. I was 15 when they came out. So I watched the movie theater. I actually didn't like it. I was young. I was dumb. It was slow to me. Brian De Palma's direction was really kind of laborious. Didn't like that. I watched the second Mission Impossible movie. Side note, I had to sell CDs. I was broke. I was very, very poor. I was a freshman in college. And so I had to go to like a CD resale place. And I sold old R&B CDs that I was listening to anymore to get money to go to watch this movie. I think I sold like 10 of them. Those of you who are listening probably don't know anything about that. Anyway, but I sold CDs to watch the second one, and I was very disappointed. Didn't like it at all. I thought that the action was okay, but I was a really big John Woo fan, and I was expecting more from it. So those movies went by. Didn't like them.
Slow motion doves. What else do you need? That's this.
The third movie, directed by J.J. Abrams, felt very television-ish to me.
Totally.
Didn't like it that much. But I kept going because I was a Tom Cruise fan. I liked action. I will say that Philip Seymour Hoffman in that movie is really good. But that's about the only good thing about that particular film. Then number four hit. Okay? Number four hit. So number one is Brian De Palma. Number two is John Woo. Number three is J.J. Abrams. Then Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol hit. That's directed by Brad Bird. I was all in from that point forward. I loved it. That is when they kind of started figuring out the formula. They weren't playing with it anymore. And with that film, and then after that came, I believe it's Rogue Nation. Then I was all the way in. And that's when Christopher McQuarrie jumped in. So I am a big fan of this series. I own a box set of all the DVDs and Blu-rays. I own Dead Reckoning. I'm going to own Final Reckoning. I own all these movies. I love these movies. These are very, very fun. They're dumb, to be sure, but it gives you great action scenes. I think that Rebecca Ferguson, her character, I think she shows up in Rogue Nation. I thought that she was really, really good, and I thought that was a through line. And a through line for all these movies is Tom Cruise or Ethan Hunt making bad choices because he really, really loves his friends, right? He will put the world's life on the line because he really, really loves his friends. And so in the final film, they really call upon that and draw attention to it. Now, there's stupid stuff about him being the Messiah and all kind of weird crap. I don't like that stuff. But when it talks about that, I really enjoyed it. So these are good films, right? Are they great films? No. Are they pure cinema? Sometimes. You know, the action scenes are pure cinema. Is it great character motivation? Do you get great story? Are they all coherent? Not really. I think that the only time that he kind of does that is with the Sean Harris character, who shows up, I believe, in Rogue Nation and then in Fallout. That's a little bit of a connecting thread. But, I mean, these movies, when they're hitting at their high, they're really, really high. When they're at their lowest, it's dubs, and they're flying in slow motion. But nevertheless, I really, really enjoy this series. I cannot believe that Al got on here and defamed this. I can't believe that Sarah got on here and tried to say that nothing makes sense. You guys are wrong. These are amazing films.
Yeah, I don't think I have to disagree with anything that you said there, really. But I just think so many of the choices are really interesting.
I like, actually, what Lawrence said is that how it gets going. Like, it didn't really know what it was until Ghost Protocol, basically.
Ghost Protocol is when they figured it out.
So maybe we should talk about from the beginning and how it had kind of a bumpy start and then what it actually became. What do you think about that?
I think that's a great point.
I mean, it's funny. If we could have done this episode, if we existed, after the first movie, because the first movie is a callback to an old series. Did anybody watch any of that series?
I did watch that series. I very much watched that series.
So it seemed like from the bit that I saw that it was kind of like Star Trek action in terms of the fighting and the music.
Yeah. It was a case of the week kind of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to see the Gorn fighting Kirk, but spies, there you go.
So I watched it in 1996. And I thought it was really cool. I thought the action sequences were really cool, like the blowing up of the water thing and him going down on the wire and stuff.
That's a great scene. Great scene, yeah.
But actually, and then I did a rewatch of it now. So it's almost 30 years later. And 1996, that was like 30 years after the television series debuted. And it looks like what the television series did in 1996. The 1996 movie looks like that series now. I thought some of the technology and stuff was a little bit laughable, really cheap.
That helicopter blowing up and then him, that's bad. It's just bad now.
Yeah, but I do love that scene still, that sequence with the helicopter in the tunnel.
Yes.
Is incredible.
We got a banger of a theme song out of the original thing and mm-hmm. the fact that it's going to be heists. And I didn't realize until watching now, maybe I knew this a little at the time, but that the John Voight character who, spoiler for movie one, is the leader of the team and ends up being the villain, that he was supposed to be the same person. It is, you know, as Peter Graves, the lead in the TV series. That so this is somebody you have been rooting for 6 years, however long. He wasn't on the first season, at least he wasn't on the pilot. That now, you know, so this is sort of a spit in the face of the, so to have the first movie be spitting in the face in a way, it was, you know, kind of controversial of the original thing to say, oh yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of something comparable. Yeah, if you found, if Star Trek came back and it like, oh, Captain Kirk was actually...
Like Spock was a Romulan.
Yeah, or, you know, they say this is the disappointment that people had about Luke Skywalker as an old... curmudgeonly, having quit the force and whatever. Like, it was sort of the equivalent of that. So that's pretty funny.
Although, if I remember correctly, the main star from the TV show is in the first movie, if I remember correctly. That's like a minor part, but he is in the first. I mean, so I remember there being a little bit of controversy, but like, who really had a deep affinity for that TV show that much that they're like, oh, God damn it, I can't believe they did that to my hero. Like,
I mean, we're just in the wrong generation. I don't know.
Maybe that's it.
There's somebody we could ask, maybe. But we're not.
It's one of those things that was big at the time, but it never really made its way to kind of intergenerational cult classic territory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not so, Doctor Who.
I don't think anyone cared that much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not Star Trek, not Doctor Who. But I think now, by far, the movies have surpassed the... Mm. Like, when you think of Mission Impossible,
yeah.
Maybe in the back of your mind, if you're like... me and Mark and Sarah's age, I guess Al's about our age too, that this was a TV show, but certainly the movies have certainly surpassed that by now.
Where it was really smart to make this particular adaptation for the movie that they had in mind is they got to basically ignore anything they didn't like about the TV show because no one cared that much about it. But they did get a bunch of really good memes, which were already in the culture. So like, your mission should you choose to accept it, the exploding tape. Like, I knew about all that stuff before I saw the first movie, but not because I'd seen the TV show, but because I'd seen it referenced in
Inspector like, Gadget or whatever.
Inspector Gadget and like all of that stuff. So they got to take all of these memes going into making it, but not have to care too much about like respecting the source material, which is exactly what they did.
Yeah, that was sort of the brilliant part.
I saw a few bits of the TV show and the action wasn't as good as the TV series, but, you know, the dialogue and the drama was pretty gripping. Like, that stuff isn't really in the movies at all. But you could have made a more faithful, kind of ponderous, I go like latter-day James Bond style adaptation.
I think that's what they were trying to do with that first film, though.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Because the tone of that first film is very much different than the tone of these latter films. That first film is a hardcore espionage thriller, right? And it really takes its time. I think that the beginning of that first film maybe is among my favorite of set pieces in the entire series because it's very espionage. You just see his team die one by one. Mm-hmm. It's kind of tense. I really enjoyed that. But that is more in line with the TV show, right? What this became was a large-scale spectacle. That first movie is relatively small. Outside of that weird CGI thing that Al likes when the helicopter blows up. But outside of that, it is a relatively small film. Then it becomes flying through the air, jumping off of buildings, all that kind of stuff later on. But that first film is very much more faithful to the tone of how the TV show was. At least that's how I remember it.
The tone kind of shifted. Like, you go from the first movie, and much of it is very serious. And that's actually one thing I kind of admire about the whole series is the seriousness with which they deliver that dialogue, some of that dialogue is rough. And the fact that they can do that with a straight face, kudos to all of them. I absolutely have mad respect for that. But the second film, the John Woo film, we were so excited. We went to the theater for that because we love John Woo films. And that movie tonally was so, it was so all over the place. It was so stupid. That flirty drive sequence, you know, that he has with Tandy
Newton.
Thank you. And I love her, but holy moly, it was so tone deaf. That flirty drive sequence, they're having other, you know, innocent lives they're running other cars off the road and all that kind of stuff just because it's fun. You know, it's like, no, you know, a lot of the male gazey stuff has not aged well in that movie. It was so cringy.
And the Limp Bizkit song. Yeah. You remember the Limp Bizkit song?
Yeah.
The Limp Bizkit song?
That was in part two. God.
But, and so it really took a while, you know, like, and I love J.J. Abrams, too.
I love him on TV. I don't love his movies.
Yeah, I love him on TV. It felt such like an extended episode of Felicity, you know?
Hey, it was Alias.
But don't you love the way he puts lens flare in dialogue scenes?
I do love it.
He does use all of his peeps. That's nice. But, you know, it didn't really feel like it kind of got going. And they were take, you know, certain things from it, you know, like all of the action sequences were fabulous. I love the masks, you know, pulling off the masks. You know, the villain in the third one was the best villain out of all of them.
So good.
He was so great.
Yeah. Like he is like so much bigger than that film. Like he is so much better than that film deserves. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And how nice at this point, right after White Lotus, to see Michelle Monaghan in her peak of her cuteness. Like, I didn't remember that it was the same person.
Wow. Are you trying to say she's old?
She
what are you saying,
so Mark?
No, she is, but
what's
like,
going on, Mark?
She is she was, gorgeous. Yes,
but there obviously there's a difference in casting. It's the same with Tandy Newton. She does great stuff now, but like, I did not remember her as a, 22-year-old or whatever, as prepped up in this way. She plays more sort of intellectual characters now that are still hot.
She can't help it.
I feel like you're digging a hole, Mark. I feel like you're digging a hole there, man. I'm gonna let you dig that hole by yourself, Mark.
I just thought people avoid part two because it is objectively the worst film, but I just thought it was hilariously awful. Stupid. I just loved it. I got to just spoil the dumbest part, which I remember being tickled by when I saw it the first time, where Tom Cruise and the main henchman have been fighting, and then the henchman drags Tom Cruise all beaten up back in to his boss, and his boss is reveling in this and is going to shoot him, and the henchman's like, oh, I broke his jaw, he can't even talk. And it turned out, like, yes, as they were running in the hallway, somehow he had the life masks of himself and of this henchman. Why would he even have that on hand? So he could switch them just so that the boss could then shoot his own henchmen. And this could be a big reveal to the audience. It was just the most ridiculous thing in any of the movies.
Not great.
And that's saying something, because this whole series is pretty ridiculous sometimes.
I think the most dumb thing was that I saw was from that movie as well. And it's, I think, in the opening sequence when... is it Tom Cruise or someone else is being approached by a woman and he's got his like phone device and she's obviously coming to try and kill him and it just flashes up assassin on the phone.
Oh yeah.
So that the audience
knows.
Well,
that's Josh Holloway in the number three.
Oh, is that number three or four? I don't know, but that illustrates two points, though, is that one, these movies blend into one another.
They really do.
Even Lawrence in presenting the sequence, you screwed up a few things, but I don't think we don't need to quibble over the, but
it's fine.
Yes.
And secondly, I'm happy to accept the general judgment that the number two is the most dumb one, but these movies are all very dumb. They are all very, very dumb in a number of respects.
Not all of them.
I think they're all dumb, but that's okay. I think the mistake that the movies make sometimes is in trying to apologize for that dumbness. And that leads to them being boring sometimes. Because they have these nonsensical plots, right? And that's fine, because the movies are all about getting you from one action set piece to another.
Exactly.
They're explicitly written that way. That they plan the action sequences first, at least these last four movies.
Man... I so deeply disagree with you, man.
The weirdest choice I think that this film franchise makes is in trying too hard to set up these action scenes. because they're not good at it. The series clearly doesn't value the dialogue scenes in the way that it values the action scenes, and that's fine. And the reason you know that is because the action scenes are all shot incredibly, you don't want to say boringly, but there's like, they're standard, it's all very standard two-shot dialogue scenes. In those dialogue scenes, you have often world-class character actors who are just standing still and staring like dead-eyed at the camera. Like Tom Cruise himself is a world-class character actor. Simon Pegg is a world-class comedic actor and a perfectly fine character actor. Neither of those guys have any, there's not a single dialogue scene that either of them had through the whole series of the film, which is actually like gripping. They're just there to deliver the dialogue. So that being the case, it really confuses me why they spend so long in the dialogue scenes. I would often lose focus for a little while and then come back 10 minutes later and think, I must have missed some important dialogue, but they're just repeating the same thing that they had already said like at the beginning of the dialogue scene.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just so confused why they took so long over doing something that they just don't care about. And obviously the answer is because you need to make sure the Chinese audiences are going to follow along. So you've got to say everything three times and you've got to make sure that everything's easily translatable. But it's just a weird watching experience because anything in between the action scenes is like confusing and boring all at the same time. And it's just very weird to see so much of the movie be done at a world-class level and the rest of the movie, it just feels like B-movie action schlock.
All right, now let me tell you why you're wrong. Okay, so you did this long soliloquy, and Sarah's like, yeah, you're right, and now you're fucking wrong. Let me tell you why. So when you look at Fallout, for example, and if you don't believe me, you can look at many, many different reviews. I believe the Big Picture just did a podcast, the Ringer's Big Picture did a podcast naming it one of the 25 best films of the century. It is a really, really good film.
It's definitely the best in this series.
Yeah, I just finished it. It's great.
Anyone can do a podcast, Lawrence.
What am I doing here? What's going on? Anyway, nevertheless, right? That film is by far really, really good. From the beginning to the end, if you watch Henry Cavill, you'll see hints of him not being a good guy. He's trying to undermine things. The action is really, really good, yes, but also the dialogue in that film is really, really good. You have Angela Bassett cooking in that movie. You have Alec Baldwin cooking in that movie. You have Sean Harris cooking in that movie. I would say that Ving Rhames is the best in that particular film. I would say that Simon Pegg is the best in that particular film. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise in all these films. You know, he hasn't really been that good to me since Magnolia. But nevertheless, the bottom line is that that is an example of a film that is doing exactly the opposite of what you're saying it's doing. It is not padding. It is actually trying to be a good film. Now, Rogue Nation, sure. Dead Reckoning, certainly. Last Reckoning, whatever. All these Reckonings, sure. But I would say that Fallout is legitimately a very, very good action film. If you look at it on its own terms, now don't worry about the connection to the other films, but that film on its own is a very, very good, interesting action film. It's doing something that the other films were not trying to do. That, I would say, stands out as the exception, even though all of you guys are like, ho-humming this entire series. I'm telling you, that is a really, really good film.
I'm happy to accept that there are exceptions to prove the rule.
Well, if you do that, I'm good with that. There's an exception, though.
I don't think that you guys are actually disagreeing. I think that you guys are both enjoying the movie. You're saying enjoy it on its terms. You know, I just watched Fallout, and you're right. Fallout is the best of the series, and I was genuinely entertained from beginning to end. However, there is still a lot of padding. There is still a lot of explaining, explaining.
Yeah.
And I understand why they're doing it. And Angela Bassett, you're right. She is cooking, but she is also giving some horrific dialogue to have us believe. And that is fine. That is fine. We know what we're signing up for when we go to see these movies. We know exactly what we want.
Exactly. And that's what confuses me about it, because they know that what the audience is coming for. The audience is going to give them all the leeway in the world to get from one action scene to the next. Like, I want to link this to the last film, because I think the last film is extremely revealing of the whole series, the penultimate one to a lesser extent. But the last film, so I referred to it as an exercise in gaslighting before. And the reason I say that is because the last film tries to make us believe a whole bunch of things retroactively about all of the other films that we've seen. So firstly, that Tom Cruise had a character arc. That's one thing it tries to resolve.
I agree with that. I do agree with that.
So there's like the stupid stuff, like all the plots were connected all along, and like, fine, you know, get away with that, whatever. But that, oh, I found it so deeply uncomfortable how many times in that film a room full of important people gathered around Tom Cruise and said, Tom Cruise, you are such a good person. You are so good at your job, Tom Cruise. We love everything. We're sorry we didn't appreciate you, Tom Cruise.
I agree. And, I completely agree.
And also, here's these pamphlets for Scientology.
Yeah.
That is not, Mark, you're being unkind. They don't unkind.
The whole series takes itself just a little bit too seriously, I think. And I think the last film demonstrates that the reason it took itself too seriously is because ultimately Tom Cruise is very insecure about the kind of movies that he's making for some reason, because everybody loves the Tom Cruise circus. We all queue up around the block to see the Tom Cruise circus. But I guess Tom Cruise still knows that he's also Tom Cruise, who is in A Few Good Men, and he wants also to be doing more. I don't know. I don't know why.
I don't know if he wants to be doing that anymore.
I think he does.
It feels like he wants to be revered in a kind of uncomfortable way, and that maybe explains like the padding, why the plots are convoluted sometimes, why the characters are convoluted and messy. And he, even though he gives the public what they want, he also wants to give the public a lot of stuff that they don't care about. Is kind of the takeaway.
Could I augment that with, I had just by coincidence seen on Facebook some clip from, I don't know when, it could be recent, could be really old, Louis C.K. making fun of Good Will Hunting and how this character, and he's a man of the people and he's a genius, is only understandable if you realize that Matt Damon wrote this for himself. That this was a, and I see that we talked about Will Smith, that every Will Smith movie recently, he has to be such a badass. Because he has too much creative control over the kind of things he's in. And so, yes, is this a cult of Tom Cruise that I think it should be? This is an anonymous, unknown, thankless task. They should not be just literally thanking him over and over again and know so much about his character and being thinking, you know, that some of them don't appreciate him, but they are shown to be wrong. And this is just totally out of character with what the IMF is supposed to be.
It's better than that, because they try and have their cake and eat it too, because they explicitly say in the last film, when the guy leaves him the voice note at the end on the USB stick, and he says, this is a job that you will never be thanked for. And like four times in this movie, he's already been thanked by like the president and the national security advisor and everybody else.
And then Princess Leia praises the medal around
his skull. Okay, that's too far. I mean, I think that Tom Cruise is an amazing actor when he's giving the right material. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is look at, like, as I already said earlier, Magnolia. I thought he was really good in Jerry Maguire. Like, when he is given the right material, he is really, really good. The only thing is, he's never actually won that Oscar. And I think he really wants it. And I think that the fact that he hasn't gotten that Oscar has kind of turned him into this. And he's also a deeply weird human being. I don't know if you guys know this phraseology, but glazing. So it's this new hip thing that the kids are talking about, where you talk really, really good about a person unnecessarily. He glazes himself. That's what he does. Like, he loves to like have films. Why is he shirtless in like 40% of this last film?
Very good question.
The only reason is because he wants to show everybody, look at me, I'm 60 something, but I still got it. Like, that's what he's doing. And so I think that a lot of these films, particularly these latter films, these last two, are all about like the cult of Tom Cruise. And I agree with you, Al, on that point. I don't like that part of this, you know, and the whole, you're the Messiah, it's always been you, we needed you to do these kinds of things. I didn't like that. I didn't like that part of this last film. But nevertheless, I do enjoy the films. But I think that he needs to get away from this action stuff. Like, Oblivion was okay, but like, get away from this action stuff. He's done with Mission Impossible, hopefully. Like, do an actual acting role. Remake a Glengarry Glen Ross. I don't know. Do something else. Because he needs to do something where he actually gets to act. A genuinely deep acting performance, because he has it in him. He is such a good actor when he wants to be. He's just been doing this lazy stuff where he just runs for the past few years.
Lazy?
Yeah.
That's not the word.
Yeah, it's not, you can't call it lazy.
It is physically exertion, but like intellectually lazy for him. It really is.
Yeah. Even but I mean, you make a really good point about the writing, but I would say even more than that, he needs to be directed.
I agree.
The problem with Tom Cruise is that he now, and Magnolia's is probably the last time that this wasn't the case, he is always going to be the most powerful person on set. Who's going to direct him properly now?
You know, if Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, something like that, they would direct the shit out of him. But he needs to work with someone who's more powerful than him.
He has worked with really great directors. I think, like, he is so on message. And his message is actually, I don't know that he wants the world to think of him as this great human being necessarily. But I definitely think that he wants the world to think of him as a great movie star. And that's sort of savior of movies, you know, like he does his own stunts supposedly, you know, and that has been such a huge message for him, as if he's putting his life on the line for a movie, which seems ridiculous. However, stunt people do that all the time and they're not big movie stars like Tom Cruise is. But I feel like his messaging is so very specific, because I don't think he wants the world to know him as a human being. When he did that, you know, back in what, 06, when he was jumping on Oprah's couch, he learned right away that we were not interested in that, or we thought that was weird, and we made fun of him mercilessly for that. However, I do think that there's a sense of humor about himself in there. You know, I think he is a really good actor. And,
definitely.
You know, he did that Les Grossman from Tropic Thunder, which was hilarious. Right.
Really good.
He wanted to bring that character back. I think there's been talk about bringing that back. So I think that there is more to him, but his messaging lately has been, or not even lately, for the past 20 years, has been, look at me, I'm a big movie star, you're welcome.
He needs to get out of his own way.
It's just a little bit embarrassing. So you mentioned him having his shirt off in the last movie. I was so embarrassed for him when there was that scene where he was fighting shirtless against a heavily muscled, like, 20-year-old blonde
in
guy.
In his underwear, by the way. It was not just shirtless, but he was, in his underpants.
And the dude was fully clothed. Like, it's no sense.
Absolutely. And he just beat the crap out of this guy because, obviously, and it was just really embarrassing. The last couple of movies, like, there were some uncomfortable close-ups, I think, of Tom Cruise's face. The intense expression doesn't read the same on film as it used to 20 years ago.
That's the Botox. That's the reason why it's not as intense as it used to be.
So I hadn't researched Christopher McQuarrie, the director of these last movies, but I'm just looking at his wiki.
That dude is incredible.
Well, he's just that he, that he was the screenwriter for The Usual Suspects. So, like, this guy knows how to put together.
He knows how to write a
story.
Film,
But then he just apparently seems like he got bought by Tom Cruise. And it's like every Tom Cruise thing, and almost only the Tom Cruise things between 2008 and the present, like that McQuarrie has directed and or co-written, including, you know, was a writer on Top Gun Maverick, was a writer on The Mummy. I guess he's just, you know, Tom Cruise's pal. And I was just reading an interview with him this morning in the New York Times where he talked about the next film, which they didn't give the title to, but that I think is kind of what we wanted to do with the recent Mission Impossible films, which is have it almost no dialogue, like closer to John Wick, that we're just going to go all action. So it's exactly the opposite of what you were saying, Lawrence. We're not going to have more acting chops. It's going to be, well, acting just in terms of his expressions and his physicality, and not, you know, that's, if we could have gotten away with doing that in the Mission Impossible movies and gotten rid of all this exposition, we would have, is kind of what he said in this interview.
That would be great.
That would have been nice if they had done that in Final Reckoning. I wish they had done that, but no, they did the opposite of that.
That makes sense for him because, honestly, the first time that him and Tom Cruise worked together was on Valkyrie. He was a writer for that particular film. I don't even know if you guys remember that film, but he was a writer on that particular film. That was the first time they worked together. And Christopher McQuarrie, if you know anything about that guy, he's a big fan of those spectacle action films, like, you know, Bridge on the River Kwai, like those kinds of films. He's a big fan of those films. And so that does not surprise me at all that he would want to make a film that is all action, all spectacle, minimal dialogue. And I agree with Sarah that if he had done, I think Al said this kind of implicitly as well, if he had done that kind of approach to this film, it would have been a much better film. So McQuarrie is a really good writer. Like, he knows the intricacies of writing. As a director, I think he's interested in those spectacles. But as a writer, he's much more of a introverted kind of character study kind of guy. And so I would like to see McQuarrie in particular, because I'm a big fan of him. I remember The Usual Suspects. He came out with a movie called The Way of the Gun right after it. You guys don't even know about the particular film. Like, he's really, really good at those kind of crime story, interesting characters kind of stuff. So I want him to be writing more, directing less. Because outside of like Fallout, I'm kind of underwhelmed by his direction. I don't love it, really. So I need for him to make a film, well, to write a film that kind of goes back to who he was originally. Like something along the lines of The Way of the Gun, The Usual Suspect, Valkyrie, even The Tourist, I thought was interesting. Like, he's good when it comes to that character kind of stuff. And so I want to see him kind of do that kind of stuff, because I think that Christopher McQuarrie is an incredible talent. He just hasn't been used properly. Now you guys are all Googling Christopher McQuarrie.
He's done rewrites on some of the worst movies of the last 20 years, like Batman and Robin, World War Z, The Wolverine.
Yeah, they bring him in to try to fix the mess that they've created. Yeah. That's what he is. He was a script doctor there for a long time.
Because it's so stretched out, I mean, it's just interesting that it's only been a sort of a coherent, it's been an increasingly coherent vision, Al, you're referring to as gaslighting, to pretend that it was from the beginning, but that it's just, you know, they've been acquiring the team and acquiring the consistency as they went, as long as they could keep upping the stakes. And so that's why pretty clearly this is the final film for this. Like, there's no reason to not let somebody else run with it. And probably after 5 years or 10 years, somebody will.
It's not going to be Jeremy Renner.
I was just thinking, Jeremy Renner, he should have passed it off to Jeremy Renner. That was not a good idea, what he did there. I guess Fallout did come after it, so maybe. I don't know.
What was the other one that got passed that gets confused with Matt Damon?
The Bourne films?
Yeah, was The Bourne not Born?
Yeah, Jeremy Renner has like a lot, like he's been in situations where he should have inherited great action franchises, and then guys just like took it away from him. Like, he has a lot of bad luck. He has a lot of bad luck.
Oh, big time bad luck, especially with the snowplow.
Okay, that's too far. I'm talking about professional bad luck. That was an accident. Come on.
That was also bad luck. I would say that.
You guys are cold today. Y'all are mean. Good Lord.
He's okay.
We won't even mention the app. Did you hear about the app? Jeremy Renner had a notorious app.
Oh, no.
Let's keep it moving, guys. Let's keep it moving.
I think you guys mentioned this before, is the humor that was in this series. Mm-hmm. And Dead Reckoning and The Final Reckoning are both really, really flabby. There's too much exposition. There's I couldn't believe how many like flashbacks and stuff there were. I thought, is this really necessary? And it also lacked a lot of the humor that I thought the previous movies did, which was disappointing. I was wowed by the two big action sequences in the last movie, and it was really fun to see it on a humongous screen. But it was too bad that it couldn't have ended at like Fallout or something, where that movie had kind of everything that you wanted from this particular franchise, including, and it had terrible dialogue and stuff, but it was like, who cares? Dead Reckoning and The Final Reckoning were both just really, really slow in some ways, and quite frankly, boring in lots of ways too. And I almost felt like I could have just kind of slipped in after the first hour, you know, for Final Reckoning and kind of gotten all caught up and known exactly what was going on. I don't know. What did you guys think of the last two?
I didn't hate the flashbacks. They get to have a bit of a victory lap. Right. And I like some of the compilations, especially the fact that they reshot the best kill from the whole series, which is way back in the first one where the guy gets killed by the spikes in the elevator.
Emilio Estevez, yes.
In the ceiling. Mm-hmm. They're very, very pleased with that. And I'm glad that they remembered that that was the best kill in the franchise, to bring it back in a flashback. It's just the same problem, isn't it? They spend way too long talking about everything that's going to happen and how important it is, and we just care about seeing the action films. Like, the running joke between me and my girlfriend after watching all of them was that every dialogue scene began with someone saying, "Are you telling me, or are you saying that this is the thing?"
That's true.
It was funny, and it did have a sense of humor about itself, but a few too many of the jokes were along the lines of, like, Simon Pegg tells Tom Cruise how hard something is that he's about to have to do. Tom Cruise looks incredulously at the camera. That's the joke. And I think they could have punctured their own sincerity a little bit more often for laughs, but it was a lot more of the kind of, well, we're going to be have to be the heroes again, ha, 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 kind of jokes, which didn't often get a rise out of me. Mm-mm.
Just not so far as movie two, where was it Anthony Hopkins in that movie is like, well, yeah, this is not mission difficult, is it? So it'd be...
I like that.
I thought that was actually kind of great. I thought that was a great little turn of phrase there.
Oh, I didn't realize that the voice on the tape for Fallout was Christopher McQuarrie.
Oh,
you know that?
That makes sense.
No, I didn't know that. To speak to that last film, Dead Reckoning, I actually kind of enjoyed. I think that the beginning of Dead Reckoning is actually kind of really a banger. Like that beginning is really, really good. And the driving sequence was at Rome. I really enjoyed that. And, you know, I thought that now the end is a little weird. I didn't love that motorcycle thingamajiggy that he did. I didn't love that. But I thought Dead Reckoning was fine. Final Reckoning feels like a film that it was supposed to be part two of Dead Reckoning. And it feels like a film that they wrote more to kind of, I don't know what was going on there. Because if it had been a legitimate, really good part one, part two film, I'd have been fine with it. And it feels like they tried to turn it into its own film. And that was where they, because all that flabby stuff at the beginning feels like it shouldn't have been there.
It was really distracting because it felt like, because they had this whole movie to set everything up that they needed to set up for the second half. So that way you could just be like nonstop.
Let's go.
Banging action scenes all the way through. And then right at the beginning of the second film, it was like, oh, here's all this stuff we forgot to tell you about in the first film, but it's really important.
Absolutely. I didn't like it at all. I watched the film twice. The first time I watched the film, I was so bored during that first hour. The second time I watched the film, I came in an hour after the film had begun because I knew that that first hour was so terrible. Like, I did not like that at all. I want them to get to the action. Like, that's what they needed to do.
Were the first and second parts actually supposed to be all in one movie? Is that right?
Yeah.
Pandemic, yes. I think, threw a wrench in it and stuff.
Is that what it was?
I think there were a lot of production problems. It was also, obviously, like, famously expensive. But, you know, I mean, all of those underwater sequences and stuff, I think, were sort of famously expensive. But I don't know if it was all supposed to be one film and they just got sidelined or I don't know what happened. But it did seem like there was a lot of drama in the production process.
The errors just seem weirdly unforced. Like, there's one particular example at the beginning of Final Reckoning. They take time to establish that there have been, like, protests on the street from people who are like, in the entity cult. But that never actually crops up again.
Which was awkward.
Yeah, I mean, we can also talk about, like, what the hell the political messaging of this film is supposed to be.
I don't think there is a good one, yeah. It's weird.
I think it's extremely cynically trying to, like, market to any particular, like, anyone in the world today is going to be able to look at that. Well, no matter what side of the divide you're on, I'm going to be able to read their view onto it. I think it's very cynically avoiding making a point while trying to pretend that it is, but that is a different conversation. But the really stupid unforced error is that they take this time to set a bunch of stuff up at the beginning of the last movie that doesn't pay off at all. So why wasting the audience's time? And I think it's got to be because, like, Tom Cruise or himself or someone very senior in production is just like, no, we've got it. It's important to make these political points.
If you're going to have a little retcon backstory about Ethan, of why he joined the IMF, at least eventually tell us who the woman is. Make that matter.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
It's supposed to illustrate why Elias, the villain, is so, he just enjoys suffering. He's so bad. And it really doesn't. It's not enough to do what it was supposed to do. Not that I want more flashbacks, but if you're going to do it, at least, like, do it effectively.
It's the cost of not giving any kind of a hoot about character development for the whole series. Because if you decided, like, at some point in the first three movies, hey, here's Ethan Hunt's core character tension, and then, like, referenced it every movie somehow, then firstly, it gives you a character hook to build in, and then you don't have to pretend that he had a character when you finally get to your finale. It's just weirdly desperate to have to retcon that much of the narrative content of your seven-film franchise. It's very, like, doing your homework at the last minute kind of vibe.
It is, and it's also what I actually love about the title sequences at the beginning is that they show these little flashes of not just previous movies, but actually the movie that you're watching. And yeah. I really like that. And it felt so unnecessary to have all of these extra flashbacks. You know, I thought I just saw a fabulous flashback sequence in the opening credits, and now I don't need any more. I'm all caught up. Thank you.
Christopher McQuarrie knows better than that. He is a good screenwriter. So I do not think he came up with the idea to do those kinds of things. So that leads me to this had to be in Tom Cruise or someone. This goes back to our point that we made earlier, and I think we're going to keep making it until we get off this damn thing, is that Tom Cruise needs someone to rein him in. Mm-hmm. He needs a strong director, a strong screenwriter, where he can come in and say, no, we need to do these things. And they say to him, no, that is not what we're doing. We're going to do these things. It's going to make the film better instead of appealing to whatever it is that you want to do. He needs a better screenwriter, a better director. He just does.
So if we take him at his word, though, that this is really all about the action sequences, I feel like it should not have ended with Fallout. Fallout was great. The helicopter action sequence at the end of Fallout is
so good.
And the way that it was mixed with his team members, I like that all the team members actually matter in some of these.
Great
that
direction.
They're doing things. Like, unless everybody comes down and does their thing by the last second, then the world is going to be destroyed or whatever. And I think that it upped, you know, okay, biplanes are not that different from helicopters, but he learned so much physical stuff about walking on the edges of planes and the whole train falling off the cliff sequence at the end of the previous movie.
Yeah.
So good.
That was stolen from Uncharted 2, but I didn't care. That's literally a scene from a video game. But they executed it
great. I mean, it's in kind of Jurassic Park 2 as well, that there's a thing that's falling off and you're trying to, anyway.
Oh, I forgot about Jurassic Park 2. You're right. That was in Jurassic Park 2. That's right. Because Vince Vaughn is that's right.
But it's good not job. But it's right. Not train car after train car where you're running to the next one and that one's falling off the cliff. And then run to the next one and that's falling off. It's hilarious. Then the villain, the French woman, the best villain. I just felt she was so gleeful in the fact that then she stuck around and became a cast member. I was very happy about.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Palm, whatever her name is. Palm, I forgot what her last name is.
I kind of like the way that the movies would like try out supporting characters and then they'd just stick around if they worked. That's a nice way of working. But it's just a real tragedy to me that we don't get a chance to see Mr. Melchek and his merry band of submariners in any further films, because they were immediately some of my favorite characters in the whole
Milchek
series.
Milchek was so incredibly good. That's not his name. What's his name in this movie? I forgot what his name
was. It doesn't matter. He's Captain Milchek.
But honestly, like, he was one of the, like, standout performances in this film. Like, of all the actors, of all the people doing things, his performance was amazing. I loved his performance. I don't know what his name was. We're going to call him Captain Milchek, but he was amazing.
Well, isn't the woman who was sort of the head underwater diver, isn't she a big deal, too? I thought she was very recognizable.
Oh, yeah. She was in a movie about, like, boxers or something, right?
There were a lot of underused people.
Yeah.
Shea Whingham.
He was underused in this.
Yeah, movie. It was underused and like, okay, we're going to make him John Voight's character's son. And that just didn't, like, who cares?
It didn't work. Yeah. He was good in the previous film, but not in this movie.
Yeah.
What about bringing back the guy that Tom Cruise had made throw up from the first one?
That was great, actually. I kind of enjoyed that.
I was so invested in that couple. I was like, you better not touch either one of those two. Oh,
I loved it as a gag, but I got really sick after because the film fools you into thinking that he's going to courageously die transmitting the coordinates to where the submarine is, but then he's fine and he's just in the rest of the movie and he doesn't.
Why do you want people to die?
It's the kind of movie it is.
He's a good actor.
He went from like a solid callback gag to just a really.
And here's the big thing: Tom Cruise cameo should have died in this last movie. If you're going to finish it off,
100%.
Have him 100%. Die in a blaze of glory.
And then everyone gets to stand around in the funeral talking about what a hero he was.
That's
one last
right.
time.
Missed opportunity.
He should have absolutely died. Simon Pegg honestly should have died as well.
Yeah.
He should have died. I was really pissed that no one died from that final sequence. That was.
Yeah, but you know what? I also thought that, what's his name's death?
Ving Rhames.
His death was actually not great. I didn't like that sequence at all. And I didn't think it
very
really
contrived.
Did that character justice.
Yeah, I agree.
No good.
I agree.
You know, he was such an important character.
And, by the way, he invented a special kind of hard drive that the industry has never been able to do. By the way, we're just looking for opportunities to say how great he was in retrospect.
He had some of the dumbest dialogue. I mean, there's a few, maybe a couple of movies earlier where it's like, can you do face recognition algorithms on the basis of a like pencil sketch? And he's like, nobody else can, but I can do it at home. So, piss off, Jesus.
But he did it, though. So why are you telling him to piss off? He got it done. He got it done.
Just firstly, other people can, to start with. And secondly, like, if other people can't, you can't do it at home, right? So I don't care. Like, if you, unless you live in a data center, you can't do it at home.
There should be sort of an A-team division of labor here. And the fact that Simon Pegg and Ving Rhames are both the same team member. They're both the tech guy. They're both the Emilio Estevez. And that it was just because they decided to bring Ving Rhames back after he wasn't in most of a movie that, like, now Benji has to go in the field. But he's sometimes also there, and sometimes they're both there in the van. And it just, it was a little awkward.
Like, yeah, well, who's the face and who's Mr. T in this, Mark?
I mean, I saw on the original show, there's like the strong man, and they show him with his shirt off to show he's the strong man. And there is the face that is like Martin Landau, and then it's Leonard Nimoy. Oh. So, yeah.
It wasn't a very balanced team, yes, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. But I like the way they did it in individual movies. And then it was a little different in every movie, and that sometimes somebody's going to betray you. It's not just going to be the same people. There almost should have been more turnover. I don't know.
We haven't really talked about the stunts. Can we round this off,
yes,
by doing like what everybody's favorite action sequence say?
Okay.
I'll start by saying I think only like one or two of the movie's domain action sequence fell flat for me. They were all really, really great for the most part. It's the easy answer, but the Burj Khalifa sequence is incredible.
Yeah, say a little more what this is.
Abseiling off the tallest building in the world, like, yes, crashing through the windows.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. I really struggle with heights, so the whole thing is very much like, nope. But firstly, obviously, the way it's all shot, the fact that it's real, the fact that it looks real, the fact that Tom Cruise is actually dangling himself off a balcony as Michael Jackson might dangle a baby. And it's really, really... It's really
shots fired at the greatest musician, well, the greatest entertainer of all time. Holy crap. Ooh,
let's not talk about Michael Jackson.
Let's not go there. Well, we could, you know, we've avoided difficult Tom Cruise topics all this time. Let's not go into Michael Jackson. But it's really thrilling. But I love especially about that sequence, the way that it's all tied. It's really neatly tied into the action of the story and the plot. And there's lovely character moments all the way through it. So yeah, one of the best action sequences I think I've seen committed to film. I love that.
Wow. I would put my vote in for the helicopter scene at the end of Fallout, but I just watched it, and it wasn't even just the fact that he's dangling from a helicopter, but that sequence where the helicopter is dangling over the side of the cliff, and he and Henry Cavill are like fighting to get that little controly thing. And I don't really have a fear of heights so much, but it makes me dizzy just watching that sequence. And I was just watching it on my stupid 60-inch TV at home, you know, that, and it was amazing. I was absolutely floored.
Lawrence, you have a favorite?
I'm torn. Okay. This is not an action sequence, but it is an interesting, really good sequence. That first heist scene in the first Mission Impossible film is really incredibly tense and good. It's not an action sequence, but it is so good, so well directed. The editing is so good. And then, like, even the minute things. Like, so, for example, the sound is not supposed to get above a certain decibel level. And then the thing breaks, and he has to pull him up. And you're watching the decibel levels go up and up and up. Like, that is such a well-directed scene. But for me, the Vienna Opera House and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, really, really good. I really enjoy that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Like, all the intricacies, the editing, the tension, all this stuff kind of coming together. That movie is not great, but all the stuff coming together to make that such a tense, interesting action thing, and you're surprised by this and surprised that this person is bad and this person dies and why are they dead and all kind of stuff, that's a really, really good one. That's the one I'm going to go for.
All right. Well, there are so many. I mean, the train thing is wonderful. I think in the second to last movie, there's a parkour one that I really enjoyed where Benji is guiding him and doesn't realize that it's in Fallout, that he's up high and is having to jump from building to building where it looks.
Oh, that was so great. Yeah.
But I think I just like the mechanics of the parking garage and the, how am I going to get down to the briefcase? Well, I'm just going to get in a car and crash it straight down. I really enjoyed that. Like, how could this work? Could I do this? I'll buckle in, the airbag will go off. Could I survive that intentionally doing that?
I want to put an honorable mention in for the extended underwater action sequences as well, because it is brilliant and gripping, and it goes on for a really long time, but it keeps you invested in the action.
And no bad guys.
It's really silent too.
I thought the Russians were going to figure out and be chasing him around down there. That's what I mean. It's a little contrived that, like, oh, the sub is about to fall. It's so further contrived.
This is, again, it's like pointless bad writing, but the action excuses it. But when they say, like, oh, you can't take metal into this thing, so you can't have an oxygen tank. Like, the IMF can hack satellites, but they can't build a plastic oxygen tank.
And I do appreciate that they kind of give, at least in Fallout and in Final Reckoning, they gave the bad guys kind of derpy deaths at the end. It was like, oh, you get hit in the face with a with a hook, or you think you have the parachute, but you do not. It's like all that. I love the fact that they gave them, instead of going out in a blaze of glory, which Tom Cruise should have done, they give them really derpy endings, which is great.
But when his parachute caught on fire in the Final Reckoning, he should have been dead. It should have been gone. That should have been the end of that dude. Like, I'm so upset.
That is literally going out in a blaze of glory.
Yes, I am so upset he didn't die in that scene.
I didn't know that was coming, and I gasped. And I thought I was unshockable by the end of that scene.
Like, I was shook. I thought the dude was dead. I thought he was gone.
And they didn't clearly show the emergency chute actually deploying, so it did look like he was just dead. And
I was so frustrated with that.
Well,
so
I think he should have landed on a horse, and then the horse is just galloping along.
And the horse would have been a puddle of blood. That's what would have happened.
Or actually, one of his friends saves him, because, wouldn't that have actually tied into what the message of the film was supposed to be about?
Just swoop in on a giant paper airplane.
Or Rebecca Ferguson should have come in and swooped in.
Maybe Jeremy Renner should have flown in at the very
end. Jeremy Renner, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Something dumb. It doesn't matter.
Or it could have just been a heaven sequence. He is reunited with, I don't know.
Heaven? We're going to heaven? Oh, wow. We're going into metaphysics.
It could have been like a Sinners ending for him.
The Sinners are supernatural. This is not supernatural. Well, maybe the AI is supernatural. I don't know. All right. Watch the movie, though, guys. Listen to it. Watch the movie. Like, you need to watch the movie. Just understand you can show up like an hour in.
Yeah. It's fun and dumb.
Yeah.
All right. The clock has been ticking down. You all got the Rubik's Cubes that I had sent you, so that if you don't have it filled out by the time this ends, then poison gas is going to come out of it.
I didn't get mine.
Then I guess you won't get the poison gas.
I guess the world is ending.
It's because I'm black. You want me to die. That's what it is.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.